Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from Sin in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
So much of the world is dependent on that oil, and it's going to have a knock-on effect, and it's not going to end as soon as the conflict ceases.
Escalating US-Israel-Iran tensions spark fears of wider war and oil disruption.
And then circumstances can change, often quite dramatically, in their home countries while they're here in Australia. And that is the purpose of the onshore protection system.
This week, the Australian government grants Iranian soccer players asylum. And later today...
The culture over the last couple of decades has been misogynistic. We've seen it.
We take a look at why the Kyle and Jackie O show came to an end. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. The Middle East is entering a tense period as conflict between the United States, Israel, and Iran escalates after a series of strikes and retaliations. The situation raises questions about Washington's goal, the possibility of regime change in Iran, and whether the conflict could spread across the region. There are also concerns about the Strait of Hormuz, a key shipping route that carries about one-fifth of the world's oil. Any disruption there could impact global energy markets. Professor Carly Thayer, an expert on international security, spoke with The Wire's Patrick Dunstan about how serious the current escalation really is.
Well, the escalation is quite serious because despite American bombing and taking out virtually all the ballistic missile, et cetera, military capabilities, Iran is targeting civilian targets, civilian economic targets, American diplomatic facilities, as well as the armaments of its enemy, Israel. And this, its proxies are in motion, but they're also being defeated. So it's spreading, but the global impact is the real kicker here, because so much of the world is dependent on that oil, and it's going to have a knock-on effect, and it's not going to end as soon as the conflict ceases.
What do you think the United States and Israel are ultimately hoping to achieve through these strikes on Iran? And given your expertise on the Vietnam War, even if some form of agreement were eventually reached, is there a risk it could prove fragile and ultimately break down in a similar fashion?
Well, first, even though the U.S. and Israel are working in tandem, one could say that Netanyahu is pulling a long trunk by the nose in some cases, and he's hell-bent on destroying the Hezbollah in Lebanon and Shiite factions in Iraq, the Houthis, and anybody that threatens Israel. The problem is that these are proxies, and now the central control from Iran has been eliminated. They can do unpredictable things on their own. And then the next is, what does winning the war mean for Trump versus Netanyahu? And they're two different things. And that's for Israel to emerge supreme and Iran to totally be bereft of any military or defense capabilities in the future. And for Donald Trump, it's to finally end the nuclear threat to the United States, the ballistic missile threat. And at the same time, the factor is that's working on Donald Trump is the rising unpopularity. Already 140 Americans wounded, 8 killed. That number is going to increase. When you drew on my Vietnam War experience, America began, the Pentagon Papers revealed, there are 86 strategic targets. If America destroyed them all, then Vietnam would cry uncle. Well, they destroyed them, and Vietnam took their equivalent of Kernel oil factories and put them all in 30-gallon drums and buried them in the road. So Iran isn't out, and it's unlikely to be out in the short term. So this war is going to be protracted.
There's been discussion in Washington about weakening or even changing the Iranian regime. Historically, the United States has struggled with attempts at effecting regime change abroad. Do you think the policymakers have learned from those experiences? And what does the Trump administration appear to see as the end goal here?
Well, there's the failure prior, from Trump's point of view, of all American attempts at regime change from Afghanistan to Iraq, to his success in Venezuela. And there's some indication that he initially thought the show of force would all of a sudden create a regime. Now that all its leaders were dead, were people below Maduro equivalent, in Iran would emerge to try to do a peace deal with the United States. And with the appointment of Khomeini's son as the new leader of Iran, that doesn't seem likely. And regime change could lead to before you get a solid regime change, you could fracture and polarize Iran into many of its ethnic groups, et cetera, and have continued turmoil, not necessarily directed against Israel, which, like the Gaza-Israel conflict, how do you stop that? Well, Israel has. Would the U.S. intervene? And because Iran was a major oil producer, it controls the oil output through the Persian Gulf. How, if you create such instability that any representative of the regime can't deliver?
The Strait of Hormuz is one of the most critical oil choke points in the world. If this conflict continues to threaten shipping through that passage, what could the consequences be for the global oil supply and economies like Australia's?
Right. Well, one, the Straits of Hormuz are effectively closed. There was a posting on American Defense that one ship had got through, but one ship does not bring the flood of oil that's needed. And so you have lots of ships just full. Oil production has got to cease because storage tanks are either destroyed or full. So even oil-producing companies, if they can't sell it, have to stop producing. And that's now going to affect, and in the weeks, it's going to lead to rising oil prices all over. We mainly think in terms of automobiles, but other countries import it and convert the oil into material that can make plastic and other goods as components for larger manufacturing. That's going to go out the window.
That was Professor Carly Thayer, an expert on international security, speaking to The Wire's Patrick Dunstan. The South Australian Osborne Shipyard will receive a $3.9 billion payment as the state becomes home to the AUKUS submarine construction site. The announcement was made last month by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese alongside South Australian Premier Peter Malinauskas as part of a $30 billion federal commitment to build submarines in Adelaide over the coming decades. The Premier said the project will boost the state for generations, but for some, the deal raises doubts. Alan Bem, advisor of international and security affairs from the Australian Institute, says the submarines are important for the Australian Air Force, but remains cautious.
It's an important decision because it's a demonstration of the need for protection. The Refugee Convention was created after World War II to recognize that people often arrive in places and need refugee protection. So Australia's decision to recognize that the Iranian soccer team's arrival here in Australia and then the circumstances that changed significantly in their home country is a recognition of the flexibility that's required to address those protection needs. And that has, you know, been the case for so many others as well.
So far, only five of the players have asked for asylum. Will more follow in the coming days?
That's something we'll have to wait to be seen. We do understand that there's, you know, been discussion for others to be offered protection if needed, but of course they do have to request it, and they'll have to take into account their personal circumstances and any concerns that they have for their safety and the safety of their family members.
Speaking of safety, what dangers may the Iranian soccer players face if they were to go back home?
Unfortunately, there's been well-documented cases of people of Iran facing direct persecution, imprisonment, you know, based on very questionable charges. We've seen people who have seen their family members disappeared, and they've faced, harsh treatment and, you know, including, you know, violence that they've had to face as a result of, you know, the simple act of even being a representative, you know, player in this international sports arena can be sufficient. But we also know that women are particularly facing difficult circumstances in Iran.
How does this decision reflect on Australia's protection visa system for people fearing to go back to their home countries?
I think it's a reflection of what is supposed to happen, both in our protection system, but also in how Australia responds to humanitarian crises. So the purpose of our onshore protection system is to be responsive to the needs of people. They arrive in Australia on a, you know, a different type of visa, and then circumstances can change, often quite dramatically, in their home countries while they're here in Australia. And that is the purpose of the onshore protection system, is to be able to respond to those needs and those changed circumstances and changed country conditions often. And they all have to be assessed. And you know, Australia still assesses those cases very carefully. And this is exactly what it's supposed to do, to be able to make sure that people can remain safe. And the same in responding to humanitarian crises, you know, having a kind of a clear, consistent framework in place to be able to respond when people arrive in Australia and those circumstances change quite dramatically, to be able to respond quickly and efficiently and effectively, and to then be able to have the Australian community be able to, you know, show their support as well.
What would this case mean for other athletes in similar situations seeking asylum from their countries?
It's again, the claims for refugee protection are assessed on an individual basis. So the Australian government is very clear that it goes through those cases on an individual basis, and people who are, you know, facing persecution and, you know, significant harm if they were to return to their home countries can go through the asylum process to be able to seek protection. And it's not just, you know, sporting people, it's people that may come here for other reasons. They may be here on a temporary basis, but there are, you know, major change circumstances in their home country or in their personal circumstances that would mean they would need to be able to seek protection. And so it would be the same situation where they're able to apply and the Australian government can assess their protection claims.
South Australian Greens leader Robert Sims ending the story with the wise Sam Giorgio. Members of the Iranian women's soccer team have been granted humanitarian visas while in Australia. The decision follows concerns the players could face serious safety risks if they were forced to return to Iran. The Refugee Council of Australia says the move highlights the importance of Australia's protection visa system, which allows people already in the country to seek safety if they fear prosecution or harm in their home country. I spoke with Refugee Council of Australia Director of Policy and Research, Rebecca Eckhard, about the decision and what it means.
Australia needs submarines. I mean, we can't really operate a defence force that can do all of the things that it's required to defend Australia without submarines within that capability. So, first point, submarines are necessary. But the second issue is whether or not nuclear-powered submarines at this point of our capability development are really a good idea. Is it a good idea then to try to produce them in Australia? There's a lot to do in realising that ambition, not least of all, given that the Americans themselves can't produce submarines at fast enough a rate to be able to meet their own needs, far less support ours. So there are some big obstacles in our achieving the ambition that we've got to acquire nuclear-powered submarines.
What have the government and opposition expectations for this project been like?
Neither the current opposition, which was, of course, the government at the time it was announced, and the current government have really put out an extensive explanation of what it's all about. Why are we getting them? What are they intended to do? Are we simply going to be an adjunct to the United States submarine force? Are we going to be independent? Are we going to be able not only to build but to certify these things? What are we going to do about buying reactors? All of that is up in the air. And then, of course, nobody has said a word about what happens to waste management, particularly nuclear waste management, coming from these submarines. And I think that members of the community really do want to know Is the waste going to be retained in Australia? If it is, what are we going to do with it? Where are we going to store it? And how safe will it be? So, as I say, there's a lot up in the air at the moment, and neither the current opposition nor the current government have ever landed any of that.
Meanwhile, the Greens have pledged to axe state government support for the AUKUS nuclear submarine program, cancel the planned training academy, and launch an inquiry into the state's involvement in the next term of parliament. South Australian Greens leader Robert Sims says the AUKUS deal raises several concerns, particularly as South Australians face increasing cost of living pressures.
I don't think the AUKUS deal is a good deal for South Australia. The Greens have been clear that we support a national defence policy and developing our defence capability here. But what AUKUS does is it outsources sovereignty over our defence to the United States, and I don't think they're a reliable partner. And indeed, what we've seen over the last week and the terrible events that are unfolding in the Middle East, where the Trump regime has just totally disregarded international law, is another reminder around why we should be very wary of hitching ourselves to that wagon. I also don't think it makes good economic sense. I mean, the Prime Minister was in South Australia a few weeks ago now, threw $30 billion at AUKUS and the submarine build here in South Australia. That's money that could be used to create long-term jobs in renewables, in making trains and trams here. It could build a lot of public housing in the middle of a housing crisis. So I think it represents warped priorities as well.
There's been a lot of information on the AUKUS deal in terms of jobs and economic benefits. But one thing I don't believe has been covered is waste management, in particular nuclear waste. Has this been discussed at all by the government or opposition?
Well, I think that's an issue that the Greens have been very concerned about. It does potentially jeopardise South Australia's reputation as a clean green state. We've always been nuclear free here in South Australia, and I think what's been proposed here really does undermine that, and that's of concern. We know also when you're dealing with nuclear waste, the two major parties, Labor and Liberals, have a habit of just dumping this waste onto regional communities that don't want it. And we don't want to see that happen either. So there's lots of questions here around AUKUS. And in terms of the point you make about jobs, the reality is with $30 billion, you could create a lot of employment in other industries.
That was Refugee Council of Australia Director of Policy and Research, Rebecca Eckard, speaking to The Wire. The government is confident fuel prices will be kept under control as the conflict continues in the Middle East, driving global oil prices higher. But with prices in capital cities over $2 and even more in regional areas, what are the strategies the government will implement? National Radio News' Noah Sikkim spoke with Andrew Lee, the Assistant Minister for Productivity, Competition, Charities and Treasury, for more.
Looking at some of the news of this last week, especially coming out of Iran and the conflict in the Middle East, a lot of concern has been going to the rising petrol prices. And we've heard in recent days that the Treasurer has empowered the ACCC to really look into petrol price gouging. So what does that actually look like when we're talking about empowering the ACCC to do something like that?
Well, the Competition Watchdog already does regular petrol price monitoring, but we've asked them in particular to look at the prices that are being charged to Australians. We do know that there's been differences in terms of the increase in fuel prices at the bowser across different states and territories, and that there's going to be a lag, typically 1 or 2 weeks, between when the oil price goes up on the world market and the petrol price goes up at the bowser. And we want to make sure Australians aren't being gouged. It's a time to use those petrol apps and to shop around, because there is more price dispersion now than we see many times. We've raised the penalties for anti-competitive conduct, and so any petrol stations that are out there erroneously claiming that their prices are due to increases in world prices, where that's not true, they face bigger penalties than ever before as a result of the new laws Labor's put in place.
Another sort of sector where we've seen you introduce anti-price gouging laws, we saw that was introduced for the supermarket industry. Is this quite a similar sort of a process? Are we looking at a very two similar industries in how they can price gouge and how we can see the trends happening, or is this completely different?
Well, our price gouging laws, which will apply to Coles and Woolworths and kick in from the 1st of July this year, are specific to the supermarket sector. Within the broader fuel sector, we've been ensuring that the ACCC has those powers in order to follow any issues of collusive conduct. There has been academic research in the last decade that's talked about tacit collusion, the ability of petrol companies to manage the weekly price cycle through signalling to one another using prices. And the ACCC's new data analysis capability will allow them to be more on top of that than ever before. The petrol price cycle, I think, does speak to challenges that are going on in the fuel market. You wouldn't think that in a highly competitive market there should be a cheap day to buy petrol or an expensive day to buy petrol. But increasingly there has been signs that that's the case across some fuel markets.
Is there any concern that some of these petrol stations are owned by supermarkets, or is that actually going to be a positive considering that there's now more scrutiny on the supermarket sector?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that has come out of the ACCC supermarket inquiry is concern over loyalty programs, and that flows into the propensity of people to shop at particular petrol stations because they get loyalty points. One of the things that we're looking at is whether supermarkets should have to provide in dollar terms the benefits to consumers of their loyalty programs. In some cases, that might suggest to consumers that actually they weren't getting that much back on loyalty programs and therefore encourage them to look for the cheapest Bowser price. That sort of competitive pressure can be useful. The more people are price sensitive, the better the prices are for everyone else.
And just briefly to the what we're actually seeing in terms of the price rises here, we've heard from your colleague, the Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, saying that it's largely people panic buying is actually causing the price spike in Australia. Is that a correct assessment, and what's actually happening?
Absolutely. We're not seeing any ships bringing oil to Australia being stopped. What we are seeing is an increase in demand, which has led to shortages in some areas. We've got the fuel reserves in Australia, which are in a better shape than they've been at any time in the last 15 years. Now we've got around 3 billion litres of diesel, 1.5 billion litres of petrol, and also stocks of jet fuel.
That was Noah Seckham with the story. For 27 years, Kyle and Jackie O's show has dominated Australia and divided it. As conversations about sexism, power and accountability shift across the media industry, many are now reassessing what the show represented and the impact it had on audiences. The Wire's Thomas Curtis spoke with Dr. Dennis Muller from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne about what he thought kept audiences hooked, even as the content pushed so many boundaries.
Look, when you look, I think, at the demographics, they tend to skew male and youngish, sort of 18 to 39. And I think probably in the current climate, what their kind of boundaryless vulgarity did was to allow them to sort of let off a bit of steam. It sort of, in some way, articulated their own frustrations, particularly, yeah. I'm afraid to say, frustrations towards women. And I think that that kind of release, if you like, is what attracted them. Kyle and Jackie O were saying things that they wanted to say and either didn't have the articulateness or the courage to say themselves. So they lived vicariously, I think, through what they heard on the Kyle and Jackie O show.
Some of the stuff they were saying, their attitude, do you think it actually reflected Australia's cultural attitude at the time, or do you think it actually helped shape them and their program for the last 27 years? What do you think about that?
I think they couldn't have succeeded without their feeling some need at the time. I think the culture over the last couple of decades has been misogynistic, We've seen it from our political leaders. We saw it from Tony Abbott. We saw it from Scott Morrison. We heard it on other radio stations, particularly Alan Jones and John Laws in Sydney. So there was, in a sense, there was leadership of the worst possible kind, but there was kind of cultural leadership which didn't exactly encourage, but certainly did not condemn misogyny and crudity. And I think that this, of course, was out on its own for those two distinctive qualities, but I think they did fit in with that general temper of the times, but attractive only to a particular slice of the population, that kind of demographic I just described.
A lot of people have said, and it's always been in discussion, that this show normalised a lot of sexist and, you know, pretty vulgar behaviour, which I'm sure has happened over time and has probably nearly got them taken off the air. What moments stood out to you the most when they were crossing the line, do you think?
I can't remember a particular episode beyond, I mean, the gross scatological stuff is what sort of stuck in my mind. Misogyny was bad enough. But then they had a segment in which they had sound of staff members urinating, and they invited their listeners to guess whether the person was male or female. There was talk about menstruation, periods. There was talk about oral sex. This kind of extreme, but not just vulgarity, it was filth.
Dr. Dennis Muller from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne, speaking with The Wire's Thomas Curtis. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company wherever you are in Australia. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between community radio stations SYN in Melbourne, 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from all across the country, with the great support from the Walkley Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headlines across your community and Indigenous radio. At the same time, on your local station. Check out all of this week's stories at our website, thewire.org.au. And follow us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on X or on Facebook and Instagram at The Wire, independent current affairs on radio around Australia. The Wire Weekly acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by SYN in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakur. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time with many more stories on The Wire Weekly.